Hello and welcome back to the Art Persists podcast, a series by Bosler Arts offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. I'm so excited for you to hear today's episode with the incredible Malek Matar, a truly phenomenal artist from Gaza, now based in London. In this episode, we talk obviously a lot about what's happening in Gaza. Just so you know, it was recorded during the ceasefire a couple of months ago, which is why we reference that a little bit, and also the exhibition she speaks of towards the end of the conversation has actually just taken place. This is such an important conversation. I think, you know, Malek is a young artist and she speaks so incredibly about this sort of responsibility she feels to create art at the time where, you know, all the universities, all the studios, all the art galleries are destroyed. And so many of the people that she speaks about, the artists she admires, the teachers who believed in her, have been killed. So it's one of those really, really important conversations. And I'm so grateful to her for joining us. And I really hope you enjoy it. My final note is that if you are listening to this and you'd like to watch it, you can watch it now on YouTube and also on Spotify. And just a note, annoying note from me to say that my video and mic unfortunately didn't come out so well, so please forgive me for that. But the most important thing is that Malek's is perfect. Enjoy. So Malek, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
And
I was wondering, I mean, my first question to you is really, how are you? Obviously, you've been through hell over the last year and a half. How are you feeling today? And yeah, how are you?
Well, I'm okay. It's a hard question.
Since the
genocide, I feel it's hard to answer. Because it's a lot that we're facing, and it's a lot to see the news and to see that there is not actually a ceasefire. But I would say I'm showing up every day to my work and to my mission and to my family and to the ones I really love and admire. So it's a constant attempts, I would say.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And how are your family? Are they in Gaza or are they out of Gaza?
So they are in Egypt. They managed to evacuate shortly before the border was shut.
Amazing.
And before Rafah was invaded by the Israeli occupation. So now they, as several hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, they are in Egypt without any status.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I imagine has a lot of other difficulties.
Yeah.
But I'm very glad to hear that they're out of Gaza. And Malek, you moved to the UK, I think in October 2023, is that right? Tell us about that.
So my first official day was in the UK was 6th of October 2023.
And
I was in Gaza back at the time. And I was trying to get out in September. And every time I go to the border, I return because the border is shut. And I managed to leave like in October 2023 through Erez checkpoint, then Jordan, and then London. So I remember I woke up on the 7th of October to seeing the news, and it was the day that my mom's school was bombed. So she survived the bombardment of her school, just like not even a minute away from the school itself. So, yes. And I'm now doing, the reason I left is to do my master's of fine art at Central St. Martin's. And it's a 2-year program, so I'm still doing the master's till the summer.
I can't even imagine how hard it must be to, first of all, be going through that and also be away from your family, and then also have to start a university, you know, be in university and be surrounded by people. I mean, how has it been in London? Have you managed to find like a strong community here of people? Is there a lot of, are you feeling the solidarity towards you and people of Gaza?
I mean, I love London. I love it. It's like a second home. And it's basically because of the community that I have, you know, I was really blessed to create around me. And they've been very supportive to Palestine, and to they've always been to vigils and protests and boycotting and doing everything right. So I would say the community has been very helpful. But when I came to the UK as a student within my school, it was extremely isolating. Because I was, at the start, I was paralyzed. I couldn't make art because I went from being very ambitious as an artist to, is my family going to make it through or not?
Yeah.
And I had instances where my friends who are residents in the UK lost their entire families. And they lost their families where my family resided or take refuge in the southern part. So it was a tormenting journey. And the most difficult part of it was the blackout. Mm. That was a psychological torture. Not to be able to call them, or to be able to even see the news. So are they alive? Are they not? It was a nightmare.
Yeah.
But I managed to create No Words, which is the largest scale painting that I did. And this painting reminds me a lot of my family and my mm-hmm. attempts to reach them. And one of the things that really changed so much in me, I was really struggling to make art at the start. And especially like being up to date with where my family is going. From here to here, they evacuated to this, they separated on the way, and it's the whole journey of displacement. But I remember that call that really changed everything. And it was my dad. I managed to call my dad, and he picks up and he's, what are you working on? And I could hear like bombardments and fires and tanks on the background. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, what's the point of anything? In times of so much uncertainty, like there's no guarantee whatsoever. He was like, but you have to tell what we are going through. You have to be our voice. And if I'm being asked this by my family, that's a big reason to do what I do. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's an amazing thing to hear, I guess. And I think, like, we're going to talk about No Words because it is an incredible work of art. And maybe just thinking back to, you know, your family, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your early life and what it was like growing up in Gaza. Obviously, war in Gaza did not begin in October 2023. The occupation didn't begin in 2023.
Yep.
I know you've been through a really difficult time, as everyone in Gaza has been through. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, but also about, you know, the things that brought you joy. Obviously, you have an incredible family.
Yeah. Well. I mean, my early years in the Gaza Strip was, I would say, affected by the fact that I'm not from Gaza. Mm-hmm. I was only 6 years old, and the teachers in UNRWA school, they spread sheets and they asked every student to write their names and where they come from. And I was like, you know, I was born here, so I'm from here. And then that was the start of a bit of a journey of confusion and the journey also of sadness, because to know that you are a refugee, but you have absolutely no way to go back to where you come from. And these stories and these narratives were told by my grandparents, and especially by my grandmother, because, yes, they were children when they were displaced in 1948, but they were very emotionally affected that every time they speak about it, you could see their tears. Mm. So for me, I had this, you know, feelings of I'm from there, but I'm also from here. But back in 2008, at the age of 8, I was going to school and it was an examination. And suddenly we were pushed out of the school by the teachers. And it was a scene I will never forget. It was thousands of young students with the honorable uniform trying to go back home because it's war, it's hard. Mm. So I was lucky to be picked by my mom, but I could see students puzzled. They don't know where home is, but they know they needed to run. And that was a series of many, many wars that erupted and kept being launched by Israel against us as Palestinians. But in despite of these attacks, there were always attempts for joy and for life and for family lives and to live Ramadan as it is, to live Eid, to live even Christmas, and to celebrate every single possibility that we can. So there was joy, there was harvesting, there was tradition and customs being celebrated in all shapes and forms. And I remember once in 2021, I was in Gaza back at the time, and it was the May war, 11 days. And during these days, there was Eid, which is a celebration in Gaza. Like it's an Islamic celebration. So no one was able to celebrate it because we were under bombardment. The day that ceasefire was announced, everyone was dressed up for Eid. So like it was, the whole ceremony was postponed till we could be able to find some peaceful moments to celebrate it. So growing up, there was a huge resilience. There's massive. And people were really, they chose life over death in many occasions, and even the art making.
That's amazing. And I mean, I think we all saw those photos recently of people breaking, you know, having iftar, you know, still in Gaza today, which was also an incredible act of, I guess, resistance as well as resilience. And it was very moving to see. And so you've actually written a children's book as well, right? Called City's Bird. How much of that is based on your own experience and your own childhood? And I think I read that it's about, you know, how to find hope and use art to find hope and strength through war. So how is that connected to your own experience of childhood?
Yeah, well, the story is pretty much my story, I would say. But it really was inspired by the, not inspired, but I felt compelled to do it after the 2021 Israeli attack on me. And it was also the realization that throughout my travels, I never came across a children's book about a Gazan child or Palestinian children inside the Gaza Strip. And it made me realize how isolating this could be, even for me as a child growing up in Gaza and knowing and feeling the military blockade around me, whether it's the sea, whether it's from the sky, whether it's the land. I started to question, like, why is this our destiny as the children of Gaza? And why aren't we able to live like the other children? And when I read a children's book growing up, I had a membership in a library. It's called Al-Qattan Center. And all the children's book, it was like all joyful, all beautiful, and all like children, you know, running and finding, playing and getting education, things like that. And I couldn't find any story that resembled my life as someone who has been through like wars like I did in the Gaza Strip. So alongside my sister, she was only 11 years old. She's also a lot into art. Her name is Jenna. We worked together into this this book that I wrote and illustrated with her guidance. So I would even like show her some thumbnails and drafts, and she would tell me, because I needed her perspective and I needed her fresh outlook. And it's called Sitti's Bird. So Sitti's meaning grandmother in Arabic. And it's indeed a story of hope, but it's more, for me, even if someone looks at it and doesn't buy it, it doesn't matter. What matters is that there is Gaza story in this book. And hence people are reminded, because 1 million children deserve to live. And deserve to live a really good and decent and a great life with education, with health, and with all their rights, and the Palestinian children have been stripped out of all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're obviously an amazing storyteller. Do you think that's what captured you to like want to create art in the first place? What, because I know you started making art when you were really young. What do you think it was, that the kind of way to express and tell your story?
Well, like as a child, I was always drawing and making art and making, but it was back in 2014 where I had no choice but make art. And it was 2014 was like before the 2023 genocide. It was by far the worst Israeli war on the Gaza Strip. It was 52 days being inside, like we were locked inside our homes. It was like really unstoppable bombardments all across the Strip. And one of these bombardments fell on the roof of my neighbor, who was like only two blocks away from where I lived. And I saw how this, like how the strike, how like the rocket fell in the building, how the ambulance pulled her body, how her body looked like, her husband mourning her death. So all of this has I witnessed, and it was really horrific. And especially knowing the kind of person she is, which is really like a really beautiful person. And since that time, and especially over like quarter of my neighborhood was being flattened, like the neighborhood shapes have changed, like how it would look like has really changed a lot. So talking about it is a luxury because no one has the power to stop it. Really, like you could be the next one, you could be killed at any second. And seeing this in front of you makes it feel so close to you. So I started making sketches and I started using it as a way to get things out. And it really, and it still is a sanctuary or a, like a refuge. It started mostly as a way of self-expression, to let things go and to have this experience of being able to process and express and to have the freedom to work. But then the more I grew up, the more I realized how important art is within the Palestinian struggle in general. Yeah. And the whole tradition of making art and the art making inside the Gaza Strip, but also within the Palestinian context. So I kept acquiring more knowledge and more understanding and studying more of the Palestinian artists and the art movement.
And who were some of your biggest influences when you were in that phase of, like, you know, defining your own style?
Yeah. So, like, to give a bit of a background, I come from, like, a family with art heritage, like, with art practice. And it starts with my maternal uncle. His name is Muhammad Musallam. He is a visual artist and an art professor. Mm-hmm. But also my mom's uncle, he is one of, like, the oldest Palestinian artist from the Gaza Strip who started like the art movement alongside Sliman Mansour, Nabil Anani, and Tamam al-Akhal, Ismail Shamoud, etc. So growing up, I was always exposed to art. And I was exposed to whether my uncle's art was a painter, like who also worked in different mediums. And throughout his travel, he would always collect art posters from Europe. And these art posters was like Van Gogh, Edgar Degas, and like Leonardo da Vinci, and etc. So at the start, I was influenced by the Western art. I was really influenced because that's my earliest exposure to art. And then I, like more and more, I started creating my own language and creating my own symbols. But to make art in the Gaza Strip, it was very, very challenging. Like, and it's challenging because it's under occupation.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like as an artist, I had the freedom to do what I wanted and to create the art I wanted, or to even have the art material that I needed.
Yeah.
And even when someone would acquire work from me from the Gaza Strip outside, I would always be like struck by the mail office telling me, it cannot be political. And the word should not be political. And I was only 15 years old. And the question was like, what is political? I didn't know. Yeah. And I didn't, my work was not really, I was not making art because I need to make a political, no, I was 15 years old. I was, my work was, it was for me, it was a personal expression.
Yeah. So the mail, so the mail, you would try and send it and they would look at it, check it. Is that what would happen?
Yeah. They would check the work and they would say, like, and it was a Palestinian mail office because we don't have like Israelis inside.
Yeah.
But the mail office would ship everything through Israel and from Israel to its destination. So every piece of work I did in the Gaza Strip, it was with this in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
Like, because, you know, if I paint water, it could be political because, you know, the water has politics.
Yeah.
And also everything around was political, but that was the censorship that I experienced in growing up as an artist. But also, like, I was banned from traveling to Jerusalem. I had a group exhibition alongside other Palestinian artists in different parts of Palestine. And my permission was rejected out of nowhere. I was only 17 years old. So, and also the other aspect was the banning the art material to come through. Yeah. And especially it would even get worse after attacks, after wars on Gaza. The material wouldn't come in for a reason, you know, because it's the time artists go to studios and do the work and do the documentation. And even tell what they saw, which is so important. And that was also all after 2023. But I can also speak a little bit about the cultural genocide and how artists and how my colleagues were killed and assassinated, in fact. And when I speak, I could even speak broadly, not only within the visual art, but for example, poetry and literature, like Dr. Rifat Larayib. Who's such an influential and important Palestinian educator and a mentor for many, many writers inside the Gaza Strip. He was assassinated. He was followed and he was always given like death threats and a lot of the messages that they are getting after him and they will kill him. And he was killed back in December.
Yeah.
December 2024. So, and also Mahassan Khatib. Mahassan Khatib, the last time I saw her, she was in my house. And she was really, to see how passionate she was about making art has even inspired me as a fellow artist. She was mostly making digital art. And she was one of the artists who truly documented so intensely what she's witnessed. She remained in the northern of the Gaza Strip. And she was starved, she was besieged, she was frozen, and lastly, she was killed by the Israeli airstrike. Mohammed Sami Qureta, a young artist, Fathi Gabin, who was not allowed, he's one of the most prominent artists inside the Gaza, in the Gaza Strip. He was not allowed exit by Israel, although he needed to be evacuated very urgently. So to speak about the loss of the artists, it's huge. It's a big number of artists who were killed and who really wanted to be voices, who really wanted to have, to create a life for themselves, to create a name and to also to spread a message. But also, like, we can talk about the cultural destruction and the heritage, the destruction of cultural centers, the archival center of the municipality. And one of the centers that are very personally affected by the destruction, it was Rashad al-Shawa Cultural Center. And it was a tribute from Leila Shawa, who was a very like a pioneering Palestinian-British artist originally from the Gaza Strip. She, along her husband, who was an architect, did this cultural center as a tribute to her father, who was the first mayor. And this center, it was very, very important in terms of openings, in terms of exhibitions, readings, and it was just near where I lived. And I always say it's the Tate of the Gaza Strip. It's very important, whether you like art, whether you are not interested in art, but it was a place that it was like a landmark. And it was also, unfortunately, disrupted by Israel. So when we speak about this mass destruction of culture and art, is what really makes it a genocide, because you are destroying the cultural life and the elements that really gave life to the people, the inhabitants of the land. Because art and culture is how we express our tie to the land. You know, making
definitely
art. Yeah, and I grew up in the notion where artists are really important. You know, artists are really not only people who have a skill or a craft. They were seen as voices.
Yeah.
So, and I go back to the call of my father. It's like, paint what we're going through, like, be our voices. But even when I called, like, my aunts and my relatives in Gaza, they would tell me, Nanak, we are going through this and this and that. You have to paint this and this and that. And I was like, I will. Because, you know, we're seen, as artists, we're seen as voices. Because we were always not only driven, we're not only, like, we're driven mostly by the message of Palestine, by the liberation of Palestine, by the struggle. And continuing to document the political struggle and what we are witnessing as people and as indigenous people.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Georgia. I hope you're enjoying this episode. While I have you on this break, I just wanted to ask a quick favour, which is that if you're enjoying this podcast, please rate us wherever you're listening, follow us, and share with friends and family. Because truly, only with your help can these really important stories be heard. Now back to the podcast.
The way I first saw you speak, actually, Malik, was at a conference a few months ago, I think towards the end of 2024, or maybe the beginning of this year. But anyway, it was on the cultural destruction of Gaza. And I think the whole day it was just talking about, like you've just spoken about now, of how, you know, the artists have been killed. The universities are rubble, the studios are gone, the archives are destroyed. I mean, it is a genocide of culture. But it was also what I guess what gave me hope in that moment was to see artists like yourself and others who are so dedicated to making work, telling the story, but also, you know, creating these different spaces. So I remember some artists talked about, you know, creating the cloud where they would put, you know, the artwork in.
Yeah, yeah.
And that actually, as much as you can try, you can never destroy people's culture. You know, it's there, it's within the people. And I think if we want to talk about No Words now, it's a hugely, I think it's going to be one of those artworks that goes down as like one of the most important artworks of history.
Thank you.
It's really, I'll put a link in when we put the, you know, for this episode so people can see it if they haven't already. But I think maybe you could tell us a little bit about it, but it's quite haunting in a way because obviously of the, it's, you know, it's not a happy piece. It's showing the genocide of Gaza. But it's also familiar because so many elements I recognize, you know, I've seen it online, I've seen it on the news, whether it's, you know, people buried under rubble or men blindfolded and lined up, you know, things like that. So it's almost like a coming together also of everything that we've you know, online have been witnessing. But yeah, tell us a little bit about that, because obviously it's also very different from the style you used to work in, you know, with vibrant colors, and now you've gone to black and white. So yeah, tell us a bit about that work.
Yeah, as you said, I would say it's maybe the most familiar piece, because even like you could tell this is this and this is that, I saw this and I saw that. And that's really what my goal was, is to make sure that nothing goes unremembered. I needed to make sure that I document every aspect of genocide, even if it was by one symbol. And when I did this painting, it's the largest piece I've ever done. It's 5 meters wide by 2 meters long. And I remember at the start, I was really paralyzed from even holding a pen, because I was really like struck and all the time traumatized by what's going to happen. But I remember I started doing this after I started making a lot of drawings. and like separate drawings, one about like a horse and the other it's a young girl. And then suddenly I was like, you know what? I just need to make one big piece and do all of that in it. You know, I just felt like it needs to be all in one piece without any interruption. And this is the idea of the big piece. And when I went to the store to get art material, I got all the art paints, all the colors that I would normally use, all the vibrant colors. And when I put them ahead of me, I could only use the black and white. So it was just a very like, it was a very dark moment in my life, but also in the Palestinian life. And I was the one thing I was very certain of was to use a horse slash donkey in the middle of the painting, because this records the biggest displacement of our history. And I needed to make it as realistic as possible, because we've seen numerous images of how animals were transporting people's belongings and furniture on the back of this animal, which looks fragile and it looks really tormented. But then also, like, it's the functions of the animals that have changed from like holding some goods and things to really doing what the ambulance would do, doing what like vans would do. And in the top of that piece, there's like a dead body of a baby. And this is about how the ambulances were targeted, like all the time. Then the horses needed to be the ambulances, transporting the injured, transporting the killed. But if you look at the other sides, I painted the cultural center, Rashad al-Shawa. And I also painted the church, St. Phosphorus Church, which really inspired the first visuals that I've witnessed when I visited. And also the oldest mosque, Al-Omari Mosque, and also Shifa Hospital. So all of these elements and architecture was also included. And I also depicted the press targeting, especially after the son of Wael al-Dahdouh, who was a journalist, gets killed. But also the numerous journalists, over 100 journalists were killed and targeted while they were reporting and working. And there's also a scene of artists getting killed, artists painting on the wall, and they are being targeted by the sniper. And the scene of people under rubble and the humanity that there is that is gone. You see a child that has a football t-shirt but still stuck under rubble. You see little feet, you see teddy bears, and you see all these elements of innocence that we always see on the news, of how teddy bears are showing up and how some like plays or games and things. So it's a piece that I did it for the people of Gaza to make, and I did it for my family, and I did it for this genocide to always be remembered and never be forgotten, because it's a betrayal to forget such hostility and such brutality. So I would say it's a holistic piece. It depicts and documents different elements, but also the education and how it was also targeted. So, yeah.
And I think the title is perfect because it's almost like, obviously, there's nothing more to say. I think if it's, with also the way that the media has covered this war, I mean, like, with that one artwork, I just feel like it means, there's nothing more that anyone can say against what is happening. There's no more you can possibly say to make us believe that what is happening in Gaza is okay, or that it's a right thing to do or a good thing to do.
It's a protest. It's a protest against these dehumanizing tactics that the media has really projected on us, not only since 2023, long, long, long before that. We were never seen as humans. And we are constantly asked to justify our existence, to look like we are, as Al-Quds says, perfect victims. We always have to justify how much we are humans. And this by itself is dehumanizing, that we are always put into like guilty unless proven the opposite kind of thing. Mm. And I do find in art a big way of protesting. Because, you know, and art always has been very dangerous in the context of colonization.
Mm.
Because the colonizers always benefit from promoting this image of how vulgar, of how terrorist we are. But then when we come with as profound creation of art, whether it's painting and poetry, installation, etc., it speaks of itself.
Yeah.
It really, it tells and speaks of the spirit of the colonized people without any script or without any explanation.
Absolutely. And I find that in your earlier works as well, because obviously you've, before, you know, No Words and your current work, you were painting a lot of women and a lot of, like, really, I find your portrayal of women in lots of different ways, lots of different paintings, really important, because it's also that idea of, like, you show women as the complex people that women are. You know, they're strong, they're sensitive, they're, you know, they love their family, but they're also resilient, and they just, I feel like I really feel that when I look at the women you portray. I know you've talked a lot about already about why you portray, you know, portray women so much, but maybe you could talk a little bit about the kind of importance of showing women, the women, the way that you show them.
Yeah. I mean, like, generally speaking, like, women are really important within the context of Palestinian art.
Mm.
And it's like, she's a symbol of the land, a symbol of providing, a symbol of protection and family. So I was really influenced by how women were depicted so beautifully in our history as Palestinian, as the Palestinian art. But speak about personally, about my personal experience, I grew up mostly with women narratives and women education. I was taught in a school only women, girls. And like, my grandmothers would speak so openly and with so much vulnerability about their journey and what they've been through and their stories and struggles and how they even raised their kids. How difficult it was to do that. Mm-hmm. What it was like to live under constant fear of displacement, of bombardments. So I was very close to these stories. And I could see so much emotions coming from these narrative and storytelling. So I started, it was really very intense, like not, in, it was very natural. So sometimes I would even, like, I say it when I was little, younger, that even when I try to paint men, it just becomes women. Like, I was just, you know, it was really, it's like the artist is influenced mostly by their surrounding and their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my environment. And I was always in awe. I was really inspired by the Palestinian women. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm genuinely in awe till now by how they never give up, how they are not really, how they are really driven by life, how they are driven by the concept of home, to still be, like, to live in a home and to provide for the children and to be a great mother, to be a great daughter, to be a great sister, and to build, really, like, the women of Gaza especially, they are builders. They build, they build lives and they build... As I said, I'm in so much awe of the woman that I met, and I always, in like, I always make acknowledgement of one Palestinian woman. She was the first woman who ever bought my work. I was only 14.
Wow!
And she was, every time I would post something, she would always make comments and she would always be supportive. And even her daughters wanted to become artists and went to an art school. And her name is Hala Saleh, and she unfortunately got killed when she evacuated from the north to the south to what's so-called the safe corridor.
Mm.
And when I see her life and her attempts to really find joy and to give positivity to as much as possible, I just my rage really goes bigger and bigger. Mm. I become angrier because she's one of the people that will never be repeated. She's one of the people who are iconic. So, yeah, it's... And my teachers, unfortunately, two of my teachers, who were also very supportive of my work, were killed with their entire families.
God.
So it's a very heartbreaking reality that a lot of the people that I grew up with no longer exist. It's difficult to process.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. Because it's like, is Gaza the same without these people? Mm. You know? It's not, because we really lost some of our dearest and most beloved people who really were like, who built the society, who really were very key in different aspects, whether it's art, education, medicine, science.
Yeah.
It's many aspects. We lost the leaders of these industries kind of thing.
Yeah.
But as I said at the conference that you were, I do have, and I know for sure that after this, thousands of people will become these people.
Yeah.
You know, they thought that Israel thought that by killing Rifat al-Ara'i that he's just done. No, but look how many people like talk about him, how many people remember him, how many people aspire to be. His books are taught amongst all the universities. So it's just a stupid thing that they do is by killing the figures they think they finished.
Yeah.
But it's a whole beginning.
Absolutely.
Of their name and legacy and inspiration. And I believe there's even more artists coming. More people are coming out and making more work and making more statements. And
definitely.
We're undefeatable. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't believe that we could be defeated as people.
No, for sure not. And what's your work looking like now? Are you still working in black and white? Are you working on big scales? Like, what is it looking like after No Words?
Well, I'm starting to explore beauty again.
Mm.
Like the beauty and the nostalgia of what has been in my memory. So as it's like I'm approaching towards the end of my master's, I'm trying my best to experiment with as many mediums and techniques as possible. But I've been, for example, the most recent work, it's a sunset. And it's a series of work of how the sun disappears in the water. But it's a very slow process. So I'm like, it's still, the documentation still carries on.
Yeah.
But there is this exploration of beauty that I'm still trying to do. Because I'm doing it also for myself.
Yeah.
I want to find joy again in my practice and in my work because it keeps me going.
Yeah.
And I just realized how important it is to be able to celebrate it after all of what we've been through. And the need of hope. I just feel like we need hope so much. Like,
yeah.
And I would want to be like, to paint that, basically.
Yeah, it's so important. And I mean, when you look to the future, if you can look to the future, if you imagine going back to Gaza, who do you want to be in that space? Like, what do you want to become in that space?
Well, I haven't done that.
Yeah, I know. It's a hard question.
I'm still really stuck in the news and so much uncertainty with Trump. Like,
oh God,
it's crazy that someone would talk about your whole country, your whole land as like a property that can be sold and bought. It's a horrendous time to be alive.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's a scary time.
Yeah.
To be alive under this administration, but also how the world has normalized a genocide to happen this way. This deep sense of depravity.
Yeah.
That couldn't even put an end to this. It really can shake in your faith in humanity. And I think the work should be focused on how we can all work together to prevent any more genocides to happen. It's time that we as a human being learn from that. But I would see like the Gaza as a final destination. It will be because, as I said earlier, I was a refugee.
Yeah.
And I am a refugee and I'm a granddaughter of a refugee. But if I were to choose a place to belong to, it will be Gaza. Because this city has given me so much that I'm in awe of how much it has given me to become an artist. And the environment I grew up with was really cultivating. Yes, do it. Yes, express it. Yes, talk. I was more censored in the UK than I was in Gaza. And I could talk about
it. Oh, yeah. Tell us. How are you censored in the UK? if you can talk about it, me don't worry.
Yeah. I mean, in the context of the school I go to, I was supposed to have a long solo exhibition inside my school, which is Central London. And a week before the opening, I was told it's cancelled. And we've been working on it and planning for a year. And it was crazy because I was just waiting for the openings. What's the end? What's the reasons? It's a complicated time. That was the reason. Which the translation for it, it's a political time.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was told, like in these conversations, that I shouldn't be making a speech at the opening of my exhibition. And the reason is like people are not interested to hear you. People are just coming to see the work and they don't want any like long paragraphs of people talking. But it is a tradition that you as an artist open your exhibition. And then I was like, okay, you can have 2 minutes. You can, but it's not, it's more than censorship. It's also like, how can anyone talk to a woman this way of telling her not to talk? And so this cancellation has been a censorship. Not being able to make a statement is a censorship. But for now, like after fighting, we do the show for only one day.
Oh my God.
Which is hysterical. It's a hysterical. It never happened that a show takes place for one day. But it's fighting the institution.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I really find very difficult is how they didn't, the discrimination I felt when comparing it to Ukraine.
Yeah.
And I you know, to be honest, I refrain from saying comparing because it's like comparing everything to nothing.
Yeah.
And for me, I had to fight with the very basic things. And the last thing I spoke to a big person in the school, are you going to make a statement about the loss of life, about the 80,000 Palestinian killed, 13,000 children? Are you going to like say something about this? And the answer was, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to take a statement. We're not going to make a stance. So to be like, amongst all of the things, but to be fighting an institution, it just tells you that this level of struggle is within everyday life. And it's not only a struggle against the state, it's a struggle against all of this connections with the state, with Israel.
No, it's, so, and it's, yeah, it's been such an interesting thing to like to watch how the censorship has just gone in every aspect of life. Yeah, every institution, everyone. And it's...
I mean, Sami Al-Halabi was censored after her exhibition was cancelled. She's one of the most important artists alive. And her show was also cancelled. So this notion of cancellation, it tells you how fragile they are.
Yeah.
That they are really threatened by a painting. You know, they're threatened by a piece of poetry and threatened by a statement.
Yeah.
So it's... and, you know, sometimes I feel like to be alive is very powerful by itself. Because, you know, we just survived an extermination, an ethnic cleansing. But we're still wake up with a mission.
Yeah.
And I think to exist against all these odds and against all these attempts to erase us, to still exist and have a high spirit, it's really resistance.
Yeah.
It is. And we will never like, and that's why we would never give up. It's not an option. Because it's not part of the struggle to give up, or at least growing up. I never saw someone saying, I'm giving up. It's not in the dictionary, I would say.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really powerful way to end this conversation. And Malek, it's just been so wonderful to speak to you.
Thank you.
You're really, like, from the moment I heard you speak, I was just blown away by you, and that's changed today. So thank you so much for coming on. And for the listeners, if you're enjoying this episode, please share it with your friends and family and rate us. And I'll put some links in the description where you can see more of Malek's amazing work.
And I love everything you're doing, like with the podcast and with the exhibitions. It's really impressive.
Oh,
and,
thank you so much.
Thank you for amplifying the voices. It's really, it's part of the fight. We need to keep doing that and even more.
Thank you so much.
Very much for making this happen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.